faces of the tattooed new wavers and their goth girlfriends when I strolled in with these bikers in full colors. Later, the same night, I was taken to the Hells Angels clubhouse by them, which is, of course, beyond impressive. Lots of couches, axes lining the wall. "For what?" I stupidly asked. "In case, John," the angel answered. "Just in case." "I see." This biker who has stopped is named Hogwash, but he's actually better looking than his name. "Get on, bro," he says with a growl, and instantly that nasty butch 50s instrumental Cross Ties by Dale Hawkins plays in my head as his musical cue. But before I can enjoy this new imagined score, he snorts, "John Waters, what the hell are you doing out here hitchhiking?" I am so relieved. I try to thank him politely, but explain I feel unsafe and too inexperienced to ride on the back of this monster Harley, especially with a member of an outlaw gang to whom I've never had the pleasure of being introduced. "When a sundowner asks a man to mount his hog, only a fool turns him down," he snarls in a steely voice, "unless he wants to go down, and I don't mean head," he explains, suddenly all business. "I mean dead." Gulp. I notice Hogwash isn't wearing a helmet, and I certainly don't see an extra one for me. "Okay," I say meekly, "but please go slowly," I beg, as I straddle the seat and wrap both arms around him tightly. "Ooh, that feels good," he taunts me in a mock little girl's voice, before gunning the engine and peeling out, leaving rubber for quite a distance down the highway. I am immediately terrified. I see the speedometer climb to 50, 60, 70, almost 80 miles an hour. I yell for him to slow down, but he answers by doing a full wheelie. I scream like a pussy. The wind is ripping through my thin hair and flattens my goiter painfully against my Adam's apple. My tattoo pops open and I can feel leakage spreading across my T-shirt. Sonny Barger, I am definitely not. "Please, please, please let me off," I beg into the void. But instead, this imbecile goes into a circle wheelie right in the middle of the fast lane as the cars and trucks' drivers lean on their horns and swerve away in the nick of time. I know I am going to die. Suddenly, he is putting his legs over the handlebars. "No, don't," I scream. "A high chair," he shouts like a banshee on crack. With that, the front of the motorcycle lifts off the ground from speed, yet he still keeps his legs dangling over the front. "I'll sleep when I'm dead," he howls, just as we go beyond a 12 o'clock wheelie where the bike has gone past balancing straight up and tips over backwards in the air. I am thrown off mid-spin and land hard on the hood of a car before bouncing off and being thrown into the hedge-like highway landscaping. Hogwash is killed instantly as his bike revolves 360 degrees twice before smashing to the asphalt and bursting into flames. A giant tractor trailer skids out of control to miss the whole mess and crushes Hogwash's burning corpse. I crawl back to the highway, feeling no pain yet, in complete shock. All I can think is, I guess this makes me an official member of the Sundowner Biker Gang. Bad Ride Number 12, Warren and Tarantula. Somehow, I'm alive. I'm sure at least one bone is broken somewhere in my body, but before I can even fully begin to feel any pain, a car pulls over. I'm not even hitchhiking yet. The guy looks okay, normal enough. A baby in the front seat is crying. I notice that it isn't strapped in a car seat in the back the way it should be for both safety and legal reasons. "You okay?" he asks, with what I think is genuine concern. "I don't know," I truthfully answered. "Get in. I'll take you to the hospital," he offers. "Maybe I shouldn't move," I argue. "Maybe I should just wait for the ambulance to arrive." The infant starts screaming hysterically with a lung power I thought not possible. "Hold the baby," the driver suddenly commands me. "Huh?" I mumble in confusion, in no shape to hold anything, much less a shrieking tyke. "Help me," he begs in a sudden emotional plea. "I'm so confused and injured, I don't know what I'm doing," and get in the vehicle. As soon as I close the door, he peels out and the baby falls on the floor. I can't believe my eyes. It goes ballistic. "Pick him up," he yells, and I'm so stunned I freeze. "Shut up, Tarantula," he screams like a maniac. "Tarantula," I say out loud in disbelief. "That's the baby's name? That's what I call him now," he shouts. "I have to. His fucking mother is a custody cunt. I gotta be careful." Oh, God, what have I got myself into now? Nobody could have luck this bad. I reach down and pick up the baby and realize that my left shoulder must be broken. Tarantula bites me. I drop him in shock and naively recoil before realizing I'd bite me too if I were in the same situation. Hey, look, mister, I begin to lecture before he cuts me off with, Warren, no use lying about my name when she's got an all-points bulletin out for me. But the kid, I gotta protect this little fucker. Little fucker. Jesus, I reach down and pick up the little boy, who hardly reacts as if he's being comforted. He howls like a banshee. Warren suddenly pulls a broken-off car aerial out from under the seat and waves it menacingly. You want another whipping? He shouts like a madman, just like Dawn Davenport in Female Trouble. Don't you hit that child, I scream in horror, holding the crazed infant close to my damaged chest. Stay out of it, Warren threatens me. You don't know what I've been through. Look, he yells in a frenzy, pointing up to an Amber Alert electronic billboard overlooking Route I-70 West. I see the description of his car and the words child abduction in flashing letters. Jesus Christ, what the fuck do I do? You said you were taking me to the hospital, I stupidly argue, but he just tosses me a couple jars of baby food and said, feed the kid. I am so overwhelmed with dread that I just do as I'm told. The baby gobbles it down, and I suddenly realize all I've had to eat in the last 4 days is dog scraps. Can I have some, too? I feebly ask. Warren nods, and I scarf down some stewed prunes. I try to burp the baby, but each time he spits up his food. Look, give yourself up, I try to convince Warren. Divorce is an emotional issue. The judges are used to this kind of drama in custody cases, and they'll understand your actions. Who said I was married? He asks, as if I were the stupidest person in the world. Well, you said she was a custody cunt, I stammer. She is, he rages, but I don't know her. I saw her on the bus with a kid, and she was letting him eat sweets. That's just wrong. I couldn't allow little Tarantula to grow up and be a fat slob, so I snatched him and ran. She starts screaming, give him back! That's a custody cunt in my book. I look out the window at normal people driving by. Families who have no idea of the hell happening right now in the lane next to them. Help! I mouth to the driver of a home pest control exterminating company. He looks at me blankly, I guess internalizing his own troubles at home. Call the police, I over-enunciate silently to a woman with her own child, snugly seat-belted in the back as she talks on the phone, probably illegally. Thinking I'm giving her shit for being on the horn by misinterpreting my lip reading of police, she hangs up guiltily and drops the handheld in her lap and never looks back. I hunt for eye contact for car to car and despair at not seeing a friendly or helpful face. Suddenly I hear a police siren in the distance. I look over at Warren and see this sound makes him totally insane. You drive, he orders, turning on the radio full volume. I can't believe it. What's playing but the song Babysittin' Boogie by Buzz Clifford? That crazy tune with the dubbed-in baby voice gurgling goo-goo da-da type lyrics. But no baby is singing along in this car. Ours is screaming bloody murder. Give me the child, he barks, taking his hands off the wheel and actually starting to try to change places with me. The car starts swerving wildly from lane to lane, and I painfully grab the wheel from my side with one hand to jerk up Tarantula by the arm with my other. With Warren's foot on the brake, we slow down quickly, and cars have to slam on their brakes behind us. I don't look back as I'm switching seats with this madman while the car almost coasts to a stop, but I hear an accident or two happening as a result. Floor it, Warren orders, grabbing the baby as the sirens get louder, and I can see a fleet of speeding cop cars approaching us in the rearview mirror. I do as I'm told. Tarantula is turning up his own volume now, screaming so loudly that I get a minor nosebleed. Holding the infant, Warren rolls down the window. I tried to be a good father, he sobs to no one in particular, suddenly flicking off the radio. I adopted this little boy to protect him. Put the baby down, I tell Warren in a new, calm voice. America is already fat, he argues back, hoisting the infant up to his open window. What are you doing? I panic, horrified to see that Warren appears to be taking aim with little Tarantula. Don't throw that baby, I scream, trying to grab back the child who was howling again, correctly sensing upcoming insane danger. Children cannot grow up obesely, Warren rants, his eyes rolling back in his head. No, Warren, no, I scream, just as he throws the baby out the side window and hits the perfect bullseye of an open window of another car driven by a healthy-looking woman in the next lane. I see the lady scream, but I'm pretty sure little Tarantula landed safely in her lap. I crane my neck to find a place in the traffic to pull over. Finally, the police will help me. I can tell them everything and end this horrible nightmare of a road trip. The hell with the book. Go back to the movies. I don't have to be behind the camera. I'll work in a movie theater. Anything but this. I'll be an usher. But before I can stop the car, Warren opens his door while I'm still speeding along and leaps out into full traffic in what has to be the most selfish suicide ever. Not only does Warren die, so do six others, including two policemen. 14 others are injured, some seriously. The pileup of smashed vehicles that crash trying to avoid his bouncing body on the highway is a sickening sight to behold. Bed ride number 13, Randy Packard. Hi, I'm Randy Packard, and I'm from React, says the trucker, looking out from his driver's side window, stalled in this multi-vehicle from hell accident. I'm half pulled over to the side of the road, and my whole body is shaking. I see mangled bodies in the road. Traffic is at a complete standstill. One car is overturned. What's React, I say cautiously, not trusting a soul anymore. It's a CB emergency channel organization made up of volunteers, many of us truckers, to assist other motorists in time of disaster. Call the police, then, I beg. There's a little baby that's been stolen who's now safe in a brown Toyota. There's an Amber Alert out for this kid right now. I see Randy talking on his CB walkie, and once he gives me the thumbs up, I feel confident that little Tarantula, or whatever the hell his name is, will be rescued. But what about me? Do I wimp out now and give up? I'm in Utah, for Christ's sake. Isn't that just two states away from California? After all I've gone through, don't I want the book to have an ending? One that isn't cowardly, anticlimactic? I can't give up now. I'm just a hitchhiker, I blurt out to Randy, honestly, hoping to get all my cards right on the table. I know you are, John, he answers with kindness and charity, and I've come to give you your last ride all the way to San Francisco. But how did you know I was here? I shout out in gratitude, suddenly feeling as if a savior had been sent from above. You've got a lot of fans, including some of the more creative types in React, he says with a friendly chuckle. The CB channels have been abuzz with your sightings since Indiana. Come on, get in. Can you walk or shall I come assist you? I can walk all right, I reply in an adrenaline rush, just thinking of my beautiful apartment waiting for me in San Francisco. I leap out of the car, but my legs give out and I stumble to the ground. Whoa, cowboy, Randy yells. I'm okay, I shout, struggling to my knees and hobbling over to the other side of the truck in hope and gratitude. Before I can even climb up, Randy has flung open the passenger door and welcome. I climb in. He's wearing no pants. Before I can react, the locks go down automatically with a scary metallic finality. I struggle to open my door, but I'm locked in. Gacy lives, mutters Randy with the evil look of Leatherface and Richard Ramirez put together. I look over in fear and can't help but see his disgusting, crooked cock with some kind of herpes infection twitching in arousal. Please, I beg, just let me out. I won't say anything. When he doesn't answer, I try a different tactic in desperation. Come on, I'm not your type. Oh, but you are my type, he says with a supremely creepy grin as the traffic begins to move. I yell help to the driver of the car next to us, but nobody's helping anybody. They all want to escape this accident mayhem. I hate all cult film directors, Randy announces with bone-chilling seriousness. But why? We just want to surprise audiences, I cry. I'd like to kill David Lynch. He seethes like a snake about ready to strike. But I know David. He's a really nice guy and an amazing director, I plead. Before I can go further, Randy blurts out a confession that freezes all words in my throat. I just killed the entire midnight cast of Rocky Horror in Salt Lake City last night. You're next. Oh, my God. This can't be true. I can't write my own death. Michelle Welbeck, one of my favorite writers, already did that. Readers will think I'm copying. Randy Hacker drives like a professional, unfortunately, so there's little chance we'll be pulled over by cops for speeding. I grow even more alarmed when I see we're headed toward Las Vegas. I don't want to die in Las Vegas. You know, fucking Quentin Tarantino, he mutters angrily. Yes, I admit, then clam up, not wanting to give out any more information. Gonna castrate him, Randy mumbles with delight as I see his repulsive dick grow an inch and vibrate. But he's just getting started. Cronenberg, he asks, but I don't want to encourage him, so I don't answer. He grabs a cattle prod and jams it into my arm, giving me a hideous electrical shock. I met him, I sob. I don't really know him. Slit his throat, Randy announces with premeditation, before continuing his little laundry list of future cult murderers. Todd Solondz, great filmmaker, I answer reluctantly. Behead the freak, he bellows before slyly asking. How about your buddy Pedro Almodovar? Yeah, he's the best director there is, I argue, hoping for Randy's mercy. I'm gonna blow his brains out, he growls, taking out a revolver from under his seat and aiming it right at me. Hold it, I yell, hoping to buy time. We are just writer-directors trying to do our job. Look, I'm sorry if my films offended you. You think eating shit is funny? Randy demands with terrifying hostility. No, no, I was just commenting on censorship laws at the time of Deep Throat, I beg. Yeah, Randy sneers before whipping out a pocket knife and stabbing me in the leg. That, he roars, looking at the blade still stuck in my flesh, is funny. Ha, ha, ha. Just repeat after me, I plead. It's only a movie. It's only a movie. It's only a movie. But this old catchline from an exploitation ad campaign doesn't do the trick. And that birth scene in Female Trouble, he charges like an obscenity prosecutor, was absolutely disgusting. Before I can even plead my defense, he shoots me in the other leg. I howl in agony. Randy's dick seems to be leaking some kind of fluid as it grows, and it's definitely not sperm. I scream for my life. We pull into the Las Vegas city limits. Time flies when you're being tortured. I see the ridiculous skyline of the town, a place filled with tourists I have spent my lifetime trying to avoid. Look, Randy, I groan through spasms of pain. Just let me out here. I promise I won't make any trash films again. I'll go make mainstream movies, I swear. It's too late for a career change, Randy snarls with murderous rage as he pulls his truck off the road into an abandoned drive-in movie theater. It's been a long time since any movies were shown here. There's not even a screen anymore, and the concession stand has been burned to the ground. The few remaining poles for the speakers have been stripped clean of working parts. Randy slams on his brakes with a sickening finality. Get in the back, Randy orders. No, Randy, please, I argue. Let's go see the Avengers. Let's go see Hollywood tentpole blockbusters. His answer? A bullet into my right foot. I almost pass out when he grabs me and throws me into the opening he has carved between the truck and the trailer he's pulling. Inside is a cult movie director torture chamber. Josie Cotton's cover version of the theme song of Who Killed Teddy Bear is playing on some sort of sound system. Beneath posters for El Topo is the decaying body of Alejandro Jodorowsky, who I thought was still alive until Randy tells me differently and takes credit. I see George Romero's amputated head hanging in a basket surrounded by posters for Night of the Living Dead and all its sequels. Enough is all Randy offers in explanation. Before I can scream, I trip over what appears to be a corpse clawed away by wild animals. Randy kicks it, and I realize this poor human is still alive. I try to look away, but Randy grabs my head in a chokehold and forces me to gaze upon this nauseating face. Oh, my God, it's Herschel Gordon Lewis, and he chuckles when he sees me. He's still got a sense of humor, even as he approaches death. As Randy pushes me forward into the bloody pit of horror, I realize this is not the barrel of a gun poking me in the back, but his erect penis, crusted and disfigured from a new venereal disease that I doubt has been diagnosed by even the most advanced contagious disease specialist. I can usually talk my way out of anything, but now I'm not so sure. I keep flashing back to the Grim Reaper character in that Ingmar Bergman film, but realize sharing this film buff memory with Randy Packard would be extremely ill-advised. Suddenly, I am hoisted in the air by a strategically placed bear trap. The claw-like grip of this catch slices into my one ankle, and I sway in agonizing helplessness, my head crotch level to Randy Packard's disgusting unit. He takes an Odorama card out of a drawer and rudely rubs it with his penis, the sores scratching the smell labels, and then pulls out a giant saber from a velvet bag and strokes his blistered hard-on with his callous fingers one last time. "No, Randy," I plead, just as the pimples on his penis pop at the exact moment he shoots a full load of infected, unsafe semen into my eyes. Thank God I barely see the blade slashing forward. It doesn't even hurt when he cuts off my head. Oh, no. I see the long white tunnel. You've got to be kidding me. This cliche couldn't be true. But it is. I feel myself elevating up through the clouds, up, up, up to what? Oh, my God. Heaven? It's fucking true? I see God, but he gives me the thumbs down. Over his shoulder, I see awful people from my past, mean nuns from Sunday school, ignorant Christian brothers who discouraged my interest in high school. I see Cardinal Sheehan, Mary Avera, the Maryland film censor. Is that Art Linkletter? Good God, Anita Bryant, all in heaven. God looks at me blankly and then whispers, "Catholics were right." I scream in horror and feel myself plunging downward past limbo, where despite updated dogma to the contrary, unbaptized babies do cry in frustration over never getting to see God. I plunge into hell and see all my deceased friends, but they can't see me or each other. It's hotter than Baltimore in August. It's a Wonderful Life plays on an extended loop on movie screens in every direction. I watch it for eternity. The Real Thing, Nonfiction. Real Ride Number 1, Daycare. Okay, here's what really happened. Real life, May 14th, 2012. No more fiction, just the truth. I notice Susan and Trish have stopped discussing my hitchhiking plans at the office. I can see their shared fear for my safety on their faces. Even my young art assistant, Jill, has caught the worry bug, sheepishly suggesting someone follow me on the road to be sure you're safe, which I, of course, reject immediately. I could tell friends my own age were also concerned. Even my criminal buddies were appalled. "Carry a gun," one warned. "Take mace," another ordered. And even the closest of my Baltimore convict friends sent me a handwritten graffiti drawing from jail that read, "Be more careful." As the day of my departure approaches, everybody's anxiety starts getting on my nerves. I have just written my fictitious death a few days ago, but nobody knows that yet. Come on, be positive, I argue in exasperation. But truth be known, I'm starting to get nervous myself. On Mother's Day, 24 hours before I leave, I try not to show my fear, kissing my mom goodbye after dinner. She has no idea why I'm vanishing, just something vague about research for a book. I figured she'd be horrified and worried if she knew I was hitchhiking. So I only tell my sisters the truth in case they need to reach me in an emergency. Will I ever see my mother again, I wonder, as I walk out her door? Sunday night at my house, it's all quiet. My medium-sized fake crocodile skin plastic tote bag is packed. 5 old pairs of boxer shorts, one of which I plan to discard each day after wearing. A pair of black 501 Levi jeans, 5 Gap t-shirts, a Scum of the Earth movie logo baseball cap, a label-free dark blue wool scarf some guests left behind at my Christmas party and never reclaimed, a Brooks Brothers dark blue wool turtleneck in case it gets chilly, a Patagonia orange nylon hooded rain jacket, and a pair of Japanese brand Sunny Sports slip-on tennis shoes illustrated with pirate ships. Supplies include a Redline tactical flashlight, a fold-up umbrella, BlackBerry wall and car chargers, an Olympus digital tape recorder and batteries, a large felt-tip marker for making hitchhiking signs, a backup pair of reading and distance glasses, sunblock, and travel-sized toiletries, including sample-sized jars of La Mer moisture cream and eye concentrate. Susan has made me purchase a Spot satellite GPS device, which supposedly tracks me anywhere, even in remote areas where cell phone coverage is non-existent. how I am supposed to get this out of my pocket and push the emergency button if someone pulls a gun on me or the car is upside down in a ditch remains unanswered. I also take a bag of raw almonds, some trail mix, and 2 little bottles of Evian water for nourishment. A fame kit to prove to cops that I'm not just homeless. A stack of autographed, embossed P.S. Thanks for the Lift business cards that a fan had sent me years ago that I recently discovered in my studio. And, of course, my triptych booklet prepared by AAA, whose employees thought I was driving across the country, not begging rides. I wake up without the alarm 5 minutes before it's supposed to go off at 6 a.m. Oh, God, it looks as if it's going to rain, but mercifully it hasn't started yet. I take a hot bath, drink some Tazo Awake Tea, the most delicious brand, which I fear will be unavailable on the road, and get dressed, putting on my new REI hiking boots that I'll never wear after this trip, waterproof gray socks, so unlike the Paul Smith ones I usually wear, maroon jeans from MAC, the best clothing store in San Francisco, a striped Agnes B. long-sleeve T-shirt, and a faux bleached-out black cotton Izzy Miyake sports jacket. I'm not totally come to Garçon deprived. My black belt was definitely designed by Ray Kawakubo. I slip my heavily edited wallet, in case I'm robbed, containing just a couple $100s of cash, 2 credit cards, only 1 bank card, and my photo ID, into my inside coat pocket. I grab my key ring with a St. Christopher medal an old friend has given me for this trip and the compass attached, which Susan forced on me, and realize in my new life on the road, I only need 1 of my keys, the one to my San Francisco apartment, my final destination. I turn on my spot tracking device, throw caution to the wind, and walk out the front door, carrying my bag and 1 other small canvas tote from Mags Brothers Limited, a UK bookshop I love, containing my different hitchhiking signs. It's completely still out. Thankfully, no neighbors are out for a morning jog. I walk up the street feeling like a troubled teenage runaway. I flash on Divine as Dawn Davenport, hitchhiking in her baby doll pajamas in my film Female Trouble, and identify with her today. I get to the corner of my road where it intersects Charles Street and begin to hitchhike north towards the Beltway, which will hopefully take me to I-70 West all the way past Denver to Route 6 north to 80 West, in Salt Lake City, and then straight into the Bay Area. But there's a problem. No cars. It's 6:30 a.m., and commuters are coming into Baltimore, not leaving the city. Finally, a few motorists, maybe 3 in 20 minutes, pass by. I realize Jill has made my I-70 West / San Francisco hitchhiking sign, so you have to turn it over and around to read it correctly, not just flip it, which makes it harder to flash to oncoming possible rides. The driver seemed to refuse to even look at me. I feel like a complete fool. I decide to walk up to the traffic light a couple of blocks away. At least here, where St. Paul Street connects, maybe there will be more cars on this well-traveled route. But no, I stand here in silence alone. Then I feel a fucking raindrop. Then another. I am 3 blocks from my Baltimore house on the first day of my book expedition, and it's raining. Something I had imagined for fiction, but in real life it's suddenly impossible to believe. I take out my hooded rain jacket and put it on as my bags begin to get wet. I probably look scarier with my hoodie pulled up, I realize. It's also harder to recognize me, and I'm embarrassed to admit I'm already hoping this will happen. Still, no rides. I've been here for, what, an hour? It continues to pour rain. I take out my umbrella. But I soon realize it is impossible to hold a sign you have to flip and turn while it's getting wetter by the second and an umbrella in the other hand at the same time. Plus, I'm sure I now look like a sopping wet junkie Mary Poppins. More cars pass me. They probably think I'm one of those homeless men who sometimes stand at this intersection holding cardboard signs begging for money. Just when I'm seriously considering going home and starting again the next day, when maybe the weather will be better, a car pulls up at the light and I hear an unfamiliar voice yell, "John Waters!" It's my first ride. A young African-American, big and beautiful, Tracy Turnblad-type woman who excitedly cries as I get in, "I loved Hairspray!" Strapped in a baby seat in the back seat is her gorgeous little daughter, who at first gives me a wary look, but then breaks into a big smile. I am so happy to meet such a brave fan. A woman with a baby. Amazing. "Where are you going?" she stammers in nervous excitement and confusion. When I explain I am hitchhiking to San Francisco, she starts laughing and screaming and waving her hands, apologizing she's only going to Northern Parkway and turning west to take her daughter to daycare, and then I have to go to work. I don't care. At least I'm in a car headed in the right direction, out of the rain, if only for a few more blocks. I wish I remembered her name, but I was in the car for such a short time and so wet and excited to get picked up that I forgot to tell myself what it was on my tape recorder when I got out of her car. I did remember to give her my first Thanks for the Lift autographed card. Boy, did she deserve it. The first kind driver who took a risk on me. I salute her. Real ride number two, minister's wife. Reality check. It's still raining and I'm only about 5 minutes at the most away from my house, but at least I've begun. I stand there for maybe 15 minutes, wondering if I should throw my original route plan to the wind and walk to the other side of the traffic light, going west to Jones Falls Expressway, and not take a ride from anyone unless they're continuing to I-70 West. But then I see a car do a U-turn going south on Charles Street and pull into a church parking lot just ahead of where I'm hitchhiking. "Are you John Waters?" the female driver asks after pulling to a stop beside me and rolling down the passenger window. "Yes, I am," I answer in gratitude. "What do you need?" she asks, maybe thinking I wanted a tow truck or a mental health practitioner. "Just a ride to I-70 West," I tell her truthfully. "Hop in," she says. At first, Sarah Finlayson, my 59-year-old fit and pretty blonde driver, routinely returning home from her morning workout, had thought I was a homeless beggar, just as I feared. But suddenly, as she chatted on the car speakerphone with her twin sister Mary, who lives in New Jersey, she told me she had blurted out, "I think I see John Waters," and decided to investigate. When I explain I am hoping to get a lift beyond the intersection of Baltimore Beltway and I-70 West, she offers to take me there, because it's raining. I know with rush hour traffic this could take at least an hour, but I just keep my mouth shut and thank her. Mary stays on speakerphone at first, I'm sure, to be certain I'm not a John Waters imposter, or worse yet, a hacker, the murdering kind. "Be careful with my sister," she timidly orders, and I assure her I will, even though any serial killer would have agreed to the same thing. "Isn't my sister's car cute?" Mary continues, nervous at first, probably just trying to keep the chatter going in a positive direction while she assures herself her sister isn't going to end up a cadaver to be tossed into Baltimore's notorious body dumping ground, Leakin Park. "It is," I agree, having no real idea if a Lexus is expensive or not. I may have been able to easily fantasize the vehicles driven by my best and worst drivers, but in real life, I'm completely unobservant about cars. Who cares what they're driving as long as they stop and pick me up? "Isn't this exciting?" Sarah enthuses with a smile Mary can't see. "I'm going to brag tonight at the conference. My sister is very nice," I hear on the speakerphone. "Her husband is a minister." It's a godsend, I realize, literally. "Are you married?" Sarah asks with sudden good-natured aggression. "No," I answer quickly before she smiles and continues. "Now, are you gay?" "Sure," I respond, and I get her immediate approval. "Okay, good." I'm slightly surprised. Good because this means I'm not a heterosexual and therefore probably not a potential rapist? Or good because, well, she's a cool lady. "You should have called me first. I'd take you the whole way," Sarah then kindly volunteers as we hit the rush hour beltway traffic, and I thank her again for going off route. "I'm very excited to help you out," she graciously responds. We're silent for a moment, but soon the sister gets nervous. "Still there?" Mary asks with a tinge of mild worry. "Sure are," I respond, "and your sister's a good driver, too." As we pass a sign for upcoming I-70 West, Sarah shows no sign of fatigue or looking for a place to drop me off, even though we have gone much further than I ever imagined she'd take me. We drive by a highway sign reading Denver, 1,700 miles, and I gulp as it starts pouring rain again. "How did you meet Divine?" Sarah asks, and I just keep talking like a phone sex worker desperate to keep a caller on the line. The longer I can keep them entertained, the farther Sarah might take me. I realize I am actually responding to both Sarah and Mary's questions with real lines from my stand-up act. "You're better than Imus in the morning," the sister cracks, singing for my supper once again. "It's raining, John," Sarah sheepishly points out, and I know she feels bad for me, so I whip out my Thanks for the Lift card and hand it over. She seems happy. Here's a souvenir that proves this whole morning actually happened. Meanwhile, Mary feels a lull in the conversation and says, "I should wake up my daughter. Don't, I beg, when I hear that the teenage girl just worked the night shift. Why would she need to talk to me? Mary tries anyway. I hear the daughter's protest mumbled into her pillow over the speakerphone, and finally, much to my relief, Mary gives up. Okay, I'll let her sleep, she sighs in celebrity introduction defeat. I guess she doesn't want to get up. Sarah is beginning to realize we are pretty far away from her home, and finally admits, I have to use the bathroom. I suggest we stop at McDonald's. I see advertised ahead. You've given me a really good start, I assure Sarah, as she turns off and I rubberneck back and see there is a return entrance ramp to I-70 with enough room for a car to pull over to pick me up hitchhiking. We're here, Sarah announces to her sister as we pull into the fast food parking lot, and I say goodbye to Mary over the speakerphone. I take my luggage inside with me just to be safe. I know Sarah won't take off with my bag, but after all, I used to break into cars myself in the 60s. Maybe I've got bad karma that way. You can never be too sure. Inside the Woodbine, Maryland McDonald's, I think of my late dad. He always liked McDonald's coffee and was a fan of their senior refill policy, even though, as far as I remember, he never had a second cup. As Sarah heads for the ladies' room, I buy her a cup. Usually I'd be having Java this time of day myself, but one thing a hitchhiker learns early, being regular can be a tricky thing on the road. So I'm nervous about starting a natural process that is obviously hindered by the randomness of thumbing a ride. I am scared to even eat. That's very nice of you, Sarah says as she returns to her cup of coffee and we sit down in a booth. I have my hitch sign out, hoping someone will notice and offer me a ride, but nobody does. Sarah even casually asks other customers if they're headed his way, but they politely make excuses. I can tell she's disappointed I'm not recognized. The downpour continues, so I slip into my rain gear while I'm still undercover inside, remembering that the umbrella is a real hindrance on the highway. Sarah is hesitant to leave McDonald's, worried about letting me off in such inclement weather, but I know it's time to part. I'm a big boy. I won't melt. We get in her car, and I direct her down the hill to where I want to be dropped, the exit 73 entrance ramp onto I-70 West. I get out, and Sarah reluctantly says goodbye. I know how hard it is for her to pull away and leave me in the torrential rain. I thank her kindly. Before I left, everybody had said a woman alone will never pick up a hitchhiker. How wrong they were. Here's a minister's wife who practices what she preaches. Not only is she smart and sassy, she's a lovely, funny lady who gives religion a good name. Thank you, Sarah. Real Ride Number 3, Glenn the Farmer. I stand on the entrance ramp with the hood of my rain jacket pulled up. I have hope. For the first time, I am hitchhiking in a place where I have no idea where I am. It feels authentic. I'm really doing this. Few cars come by, much less turn to go on the interstate. It starts raining harder than ever. There's no cover, and I am getting drenched. Even my faux crocodile bag is gradually becoming soaked by the rain. I'm too afraid to open it to see if my few clothes inside are also getting wet. My cardboard sign starts sagging, and I can't hold it up anymore. I despair for the first time. It continues to pour. I wish I were on a movie set and this deluge was coming from a rain machine, but it's not. Nobody yells cut. I tried my midlife crisis sign, but still no one stops. I cannot believe I am standing alone in the middle of nowhere like a drowned rat unable to get a ride. I look down and see the waterline stain rising on my bag, and when I look up, hooray, a pickup has stopped to give me a ride. I jump in and feel so happy. Glenn, an 81-year-old farmer, explains he's going to Frederick, which is about 40 miles away. I am 100% sure he doesn't recognize me, and it only takes me a second to realize he thinks I'm just an old guy down on my luck. Glenn talks about how much he still likes to work. His farm had been in the family for years, but one of his sons, who always wanted to learn to fly as a child, grew up, got his pilot license, and was killed doing what he loved most in a plane accident. Glenn is not sure if the rest of his children will want to continue to deliver hay, what this kind of farmer loves to do best. I tell Glenn, another safe driver, that I'm a film director and agree with him on how important it is to love your work. We both will probably die doing what we love best, I say cheerily. He doesn't say it, being too gentlemanly and polite, but I can tell he doesn't believe for one second that I'm a film director. He tells me if hay gets wet and you don't dry it out before storing it in bales, spontaneous combustion can happen and fire will break out and burn down the barn. I start to talk more about movies again, hoping to convince him I really am a director, but then realize, what's the point? He's got his own dramatic real-life scenes. Why should he need cinema, especially mine? Glenn even knows a good place to drop me off, an I-70 entrance ramp beside a strip mall in Frederick, Maryland. He pulls into a parking lot out front of the Fractured Prune, a donut shop, so he can let me out safely in the rain. I thank him profusely and am dumbfounded to see him suddenly take out his wallet and try to hand me a $10 bill. I stammer my gratitude further, but try to explain. I really don't need it. I have money and credit cards. I'm hitchhiking so I can write a book about it. But that is so kind and thoughtful of you. I can see by his merciful but indulgent smile that he doesn't buy a word of this either, but he reluctantly puts the money back in his pocket. I am shocked and incredibly moved by this man's generosity. It's still pouring rain, but as I exit his truck, I'm filled with goodwill. I look back at this real-life gracious hay farmer, and he waves goodbye with a warm, grandfatherly smile. O. McDonnell had a farm. E-I-E-I-O. Real Ride Number 4, Biker. This rain is getting on my nerves. It can't continue forever. I go into the Fractured Prune and get a hot cup of tea. Nobody is inside except the girl behind the counter, who may have glimpsed my hitchhiking sign, but shows no reaction. At least there's a bathroom I can use. After all, I am a paying customer. The men's room is perfectly clean, but I can't help feeling like the Crackers character in Pink Flamingos when at the end he says to Divine, "Let's sleep in gas station lavatories this time, Mama. Fuck permanent residences. It'll strengthen our filthiness." The rain still hasn't let up. I finish my tea and don't want to be accused of loitering, so I walk back outside. It's a great ramp for hitchhiking. Lots of cars, lots of rain. Nobody stops, but I'm still a little upbeat because I realize I can always go back inside the donut shop if I need to use the bathroom again after that morning tea. My sign is getting drenched now. Water is dripping off my rain jacket hood down onto my face. I try to make eye contact with drivers, but realize many are local, and my sign saying San Francisco is too far for them to even consider. Just when I don't think it could possibly rain any harder, it does. I can't believe it. My sign is so waterlogged that it's becoming useless. Please, God, make a car stop. I catch myself praying, feeling like a complete hypocrite. But no, another 45 minutes and still no one stops. I go back into the Fractured Prune with my tail between my legs. The manager is now out front doing chores with the same girl behind the counter, ending the breakfast shift and getting ready for the lunch crowd. I ask him if he has any cardboard I can use to make a new hitchhiking sign. He's pleasant and without commenting begins to break down a cardboard box and sadly warns me, "It's supposed to rain all day, you know." I just nod and take out my industrial-sized felt-tip marker and start making a new sign that is a little more reasonable, end of I-70 West, with the same SF for San Francisco on the reverse. This time flippable without having to turn around the whole sign horizontally. Sheepishly, I use the bathroom again. I piss when I know I can. "Okay, coward," I tell myself, "get back out there and get a ride." Rolling up my waterlogged pant cuffs, I trudge back out to the exact same hitchhiking spot and hold up my sign. One thing I can say, these waterproof boots I bought sure do work. But the sign's message doesn't. No one stops. I change tactics, ad campaigns, really, and see if humor in advertising has any effect. I try my backup "I'm not psycho" sign to see if that gets any results. I see a couple of male drivers laugh as they read it, but none put on their brakes. Maybe hitchhiking is not the time to be a comedian, I suddenly realize. I go back to my more generic version, but that doesn't work either. Big puddles are forming where I'm standing. Passing cars start to splash me in my poor bag. Thank God it's not real crocodile. Police cars go right past me. At least they don't stop and give me any trouble. At least that. It's always a shock when someone actually stops for you. It takes a second to sink in, and then you panic, grabbing your stuff, afraid people will change their minds and pull off. I jump in the van and see a blue-collar guy, maybe 40 years old, who looks friendly enough. He's not going that far, he apologizes, but promises to drop me off at an I-70 West exit that has services. I like him. He reminds me of all the real bikers I know and love from the Holiday House, a bar in Baltimore I've been hanging out in for decades, where I filmed a big scene from my concussion sex addict comedy, A Dirty Shame. Turns out he is a biker. So was his father. So was his grandfather. A long line of bikers, almost like the flip side of the Daughters of the American Revolution. Generation after generation. Debutante types and bikers. Aren't they both kind of the same? Rarified? A secret club that few are eligible to join? Their own never-changing fashions? Their coded language? Even severe body types? I notice the biker who picked me up is missing a couple of front teeth, but he's still kind of cute. He tells me he's married to a lady surgeon and speaks highly of her. She keeps him in line. He seems to like that. We talk about how the biker identity is fading fast today with young people, and how a bad white boy is more apt to copy the black gangster style if he wants to be a rebel. I can tell this rubs him the wrong way. Why would they do this, he wonders. And before he can answer himself in a way I feel could be racist, he stops himself and smiles. He knows it's a losing argument. I bet his great wife has taught him that racism is not only wrong, he likes being wrong, but stupid. He's too sweet and nice to be stupid anymore. Maybe a strong woman with a taste for bad boys has tamed him to a point where he feels relief at not having to be a troublemaker, at least for part of the time. I bet they have a great sex life and a nice relationship. He pulls off at an exit to scout the return entrance ramp for me, and seeing it's a good one lets me off. I feel happy again. I want to kiss him goodbye on the cheek, but it's only day one, so I'm still a little sheepish. I think he might have laughed. In a nice way. Real ride number 5. The Corvette Kid. It's going to get better, I keep telling myself. I'm on a roll. Having no idea where I am is kind of liberating. It's still pouring rain, but the biker wasn't lying. There are services at this exit. I see a Burger King at the top of the hill in walking distance from where I, once again, have my thumb out. Uh-oh. Almost no cars come down this road either, and the ones that do don't turn onto I-70 West. They're all local rides. What I am beginning to learn is the enemy of successful hitchhiking. A big truck with a motor running is parked right off the road a little way up from me, but I don't see any driver. Maybe he's sleeping in the back, and maybe, just maybe he'll pick me up. I stand there for at least 45 minutes. A wall of water pours down on me, and it doesn't let up. Then it gets windy. My most recently drawn sign is now sopping wet again. I feel like crying. I wish the truck driver would wake up and see me standing there helplessly, but I guess he's still sawing wood. At this rate, my trip will take 10 years, and that's if I'm lucky. I can't stand it anymore. I have to wait it out somewhere. The downpour can't continue at this strength forever. I hoof it up the hill to the Burger King. No customers are inside except for one weird-looking guy, but he refuses to even make eye contact. I ask the young girl behind the counter if she has some cardboard, and she nicely gets me a box, and I attempt to break it down. What would be a simple task for most men is, for me, as always, problematic. I rip the corners incorrectly, tearing into the sides, and end up with only 2 usable pieces of cardboard. I write the I-70 West message again, but make the letters too small to read from a distance and have to do it over. Oh, well, one dry sign is better than none. I decide, since this is an almost empty fast food restaurant, now would be a good time to try to eliminate. As long as that weird guy doesn't try to follow me inside. Oh, good. It's a single toilet with a lock on the door, and it's clean. I sit down on the toilet and remember I haven't eaten a thing. What do I expect? Shit or get off the pot? I get off. Mission canceled. Back in the restaurant, I'm not sure if I'm relieved or disappointed to see the one weird guy is gone. He might have given me a ride. Then again, he might have killed me. Oh, well, I look outside and sheets of rain are pounding the glass windows of the Burger King. I feel like such a vagrant standing inside here without a purpose. I force myself to leave. I slog back down the hill in what must be flooding conditions to my hitchhiking spot. The truck is gone. That's who the weird guy was, the driver. Maybe the other backup trucker was asleep in the bunk, snoring, getting on the other driver's nerves. I'll never know. I fucking stand there in the rain for another half hour. You can't imagine the misery of waiting for a ride in the endless pouring rain. Because of the limited peripheral vision caused by my having my rain slicker hoodie up, I don't even see the miracle suddenly happen. I just look up and there is a 1999 red Corvette ending a U-turn right in front of me. The driver, a cute, stocky blonde guy, rolls down the passenger window and asks, "How far do you need to go?" I feel like Francine Fishpaw in Polyester when Tab Hunter pulls up in a Corvette and the Odorama No. 8 smell new car begs to be scratched and sniffed. "San Francisco," I say as I climb in, and the Corvette kid, as I immediately christen him in my mind, doesn't seem to blink. "I'll take you as far as I can." From Myersville, Maryland, he's a 20-year-old sandy-haired Republican town councilman, the youngest in the state, who, dressed in T-shirt, cargo shorts, and white leather Nike sneakers, is on his way to pick up his lunch at the local Subway sandwich shop. He tells me he stopped because he feels guilty. 2 weeks ago, I saw a hitchhiker standing right where you are, and I didn't pick him up. We chat. He has no idea who I am, even after I tell him. He has never seen any of my films. I don't ask him how far he's going, and he doesn't say. I just keep talking. We both realize we'd probably headbutt on some social issues, so we wisely avoid politics. And as he puts it, potholes and how to fill them was more of a subject a town councilman like himself would deal with, and those are not exactly Republican or Democrat issues. We cross the state line into Pennsylvania, a 20-year-old transporting a senior citizen across state lines for hitchhiking fun. "Is this a federal offense?" I say out loud. We both laugh. His mother starts texting frequently, and while I don't see how he answers, he admits she's alarmed. After all, her son borrowed her car to go to lunch, and now is in another state with a supposed John Waters, whoever the hell that is, whom he picked up hitchhiking. Imagine the red flags going off in that house. I try to picture her Googling me. Great. What would come up first? That I was just awarded the Outfest Gay Award and would be performing my one-man show, This Filthy World, Gayer and Filthier in 2 months? Or my friendship with ex-Manson family member Leslie Van Houten? Or the dog shit eating scene in Pink Flamingos? Plus, how do you know it's really him? I can imagine Dad butting in. How do you know it's not some Rockefeller-type imposter serial killer or robber who's going to steal your mother's car and murder you? "Is there an Amber Alert out for you now?" I asked the Corvette kid, nervously recalling the tarantula worst ride chapter I'd already written. He laughs again. "I guess that means there's not." We keep going. We're now on an adventure. And why not, I think. What 20-year-old wouldn't want to go on such a crazy spur-of-the-moment trip? How often could this unlikely scenario repeat itself? If the kid is worried about running off with a gay cult film director, he sure isn't showing it. We talk about small-town life versus the big city, youth, dating, a girl he wants to hook up with later in the month when he goes to Joplin, Missouri, to help tornado victims rebuild their homes, drugs, show business, and taking chances in life. We see a sign in western Pennsylvania saying last food and gas for 123 miles, so we stop and I fill up the tank. He accepts with gratitude and makes no mention of turning back. We have been traveling for hours. We get back in the car and drive a short way to New Stanton Plaza and go in this Quiznos sandwich restaurant for lunch, which isn't so bad. I trust the kid, but make some excuse about bringing in my bags and signs because I have to find something inside. But the real reason is that you never know. He could get cold feet and drive off while I'm in the men's room. I buy us lunch. At first he protests, but I tell him it's the least I can do since we're now Thelma and Louise. He chuckles and says his mom and her friends always call each other that. But I can see by the kid's nervous glances to his cell phone that his mom ain't laughing now. Why is her son 160 miles away with the Prince of Puke? Have I kidnapped him? Is he fighting me off? She must really be upset because when he finally gives in and calls home, she doesn't even recognize his voice. "Who is this?" I can hear her suspiciously ask. "It's your son," the kid sputters in exasperation. Does she think it's me on the phone impersonating him and he's locked in the trunk? I offer to speak to her, but he acts as if he doesn't hear me and gets off the phone. He keeps driving. His mom keeps calling back. Finally, I hear him tell her, "I'll be home by 7 o'clock, which I know is impossible, but I don't butt in. We go through West Virginia, but just the northern tip. Another state of runaway fun. Whee! I can't believe this kid is such a daredevil. Good God, we're in Ohio. We've been driving for 4.5 hours. Even I know our little folly has to end soon. I tell him to start looking for a good exit off of I-70 West to drop me off where there are gas stations and motels. We pull off on one and both realize this is a lousy exit for hitchhiking, a big shopping center. All